I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guests today are Pat Sheeran. Pat is the Vice President at the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber, and also Chris Kemper, who is the Director of Public Relations at the Chamber. And, you know, guys, I have to tell you this. This is a interesting story that you may not know, but I know we're talking about Oktoberfest today, which is this coming weekend, September 22nd and 23rd. But the reason I'm in Cincinnati right now is because of Oktoberfest. As a younger girl, we came to visit. I love the fact that the city shut down and had a big party in the middle of Fountain Square for 2 days.
This is the second largest Oktoberfest in the world.
Second only to
the original in Munich. We actually will have a member of Munich City Council participating in our opening ceremonies this weekend, and they read a proclamation indicating that we are the largest Oktoberfest outside of their borders. This is Cincinnati's, or should I say Zincinnati's, festival. There is such a strong, great, proud German heritage in Cincinnati, and this is just one of those great ways that it manifests itself, that we'll host somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 people on Fifth Street this weekend to drink and dance and have a great time.
And Pat, I know this is your responsibility, and what a great job to have putting on a big party for 500,000 people. That's a big deal.
We like to say that we're stewards of the event. It's the community that really owns it. It's truly like the circus coming to town. We get the streets turned over to us at 6 p.m. on Friday night, and by 10 a.m. the following morning, the event is really ready to go. And when we close the event, we have it back in shape and turned over to the city of Cincinnati by 6 a.m. on Monday morning.
As Chris mentioned, there's 500,000 people approximately that will come to our downtown area. A lot of those are folks from out of town.
Yeah, actually, I've been working quite a bit with our friends at the Regional Tourism Network, talking about Oktoberfest regionally in regional markets. And they said that their studies indicate that Oktoberfest is the second largest driver of tourism in the region, second only to the Reds. So that really speaks to the broad appeal of Oktoberfest Cincinnati. We're hearing comments time and time again that people are coming in. I interacted with a gentleman on our Facebook page the other day. He's coming in for Detroit for his 21st year of Oktoberfest.
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, the food's amazing. It's wonderful. But the beer is also quite good. How many beers, Pat, would you estimate that is sold at Oktoberfest?
It is about 1,300 barrels of beer.
And 1,300 barrels of beer?
Yeah, and we have 28 different varieties of beer that we serve there. Chief among them, obviously, is Sam Adams, which is presenting sponsor of the event and brewed right here in Cincinnati. And Cincinnati's native son, Jim Cook, the founder of the Boston Beer Company, is once again coming in for the opening ceremonies, and he really just loves this event and the fact that he's able to play such a significant role in his hometown.
And I can't talk about Oktoberfest without mentioning that it also is the home of the world's biggest chicken dance.
That's right. Right on cue here. Here we go. We're all chicken dancing in the studio.
That's right.
Now.
Look, great job, Pat.
It's tough to do by this microphone here, but
so how fun is that?
You know, it is. It's one of those things that, just like the entire event, the entire region rallies around it. We've had so many fun people participate. Last year we had Joe Morgan. In the past, we've had everyone from Weird Al Yankovic to Tony Orlando to Mini-Me and all points in between.
If folks listening today would like to learn about how they can participate or actually attend, is the information on the Chamber's website?
Absolutely. We also have our Oktoberfest site is OktoberfestCincinnati.com. We're on Facebook at Oktoberfest Cincinnati. And also, if you follow the hashtag Cincinnati on Twitter, you can get the latest information.
Well, Chris and Pat, thank you so much for being my guests. And thank you for listening to Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guests today are Chris Kemper. Chris is the Director of Public Relations at the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber, and Pat Sheeran, who is the Vice President at the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. And Pat, your official role is to plan a lot of parties and events, right?
Sure. That's one of the divisions that I run, is all the major festival events in town, the Taste of Cincinnati and Oktoberfest Cincinnati, among other
community events. What a great job. And, you know, you have a big party coming up here, a big event coming up this weekend, which is Oktoberfest.
Yeah, it's actually the biggest event we do. We refer to it as America's Oktoberfest because it is the largest one outside of Munich. And as a friend of mine told me, you know, not everyone can get to Munich, but certainly everybody could get to Cincinnati. So you should be known as America's Oktoberfest. And we laid claim to that 5 years ago. And since that time, we have seen a tremendous influx of people outside the region coming and partaking in what is truly the best of Cincinnati.
I would imagine that it can be an economic driver. Mm-hmm. It could be an attraction for folks to really feel what it's like to live in Cincinnati.
Last year's Oktoberfest, you could not get a hotel room within a 15-mile radius of downtown Cincinnati. All indications are hotel rooms are really scarce this year as well. But maybe if you talk sweetly to the concierge desk, they'll be able to get you a room.
You know, the Reds are playing the Dodgers this weekend also. So you combined Oktoberfest with such a spectacular Red season and maybe a playoff preview. We're all ready to host a lot of our best friends and have a big party downtown.
When I first learned that the Chamber was the sponsor of this event, it kind of surprised me. It's like, why would the Chamber be putting on Oktoberfest? Maybe you can share that.
Sure. Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. When Pat and I converse with other chambers of commerce in the country, and I'll chat with my counterparts and I'll mention that we run the second largest Oktoberfest in the world, and they kind of go, what? You're a chamber of commerce. You know, it feels, I think, typical in Cincinnati, but it's a very atypical business for a chamber to be in. But it makes perfect sense for us. We are trying to shine the light on Cincinnati. We're trying to build our region's brand and reputation and visibility. And it's a great driver of that. We had something in the neighborhood of 900 stories nationally and internationally about Oktoberfest last year, all positioning Cincinnati as a great place to live.
How many different types of food items? How many vendors will you have there?
We have somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 food vendors and about 200 dishes. And it really runs the gamut. You can get a burger or ribs or a taco, but clearly the focus is on German food.
And what about anything new that you'd like to share that you can maybe give a sneak preview about what we can expect that might be different?
Well, for the first time ever, we're going to have a live Glockenspiel, the Enquirer Media live Glockenspiel. And for those of you who don't know what a Glockenspiel is, it's a cuckoo clock without the bird. In essence, the cuckoo clock, when it chimes, dancers come out. And so we are constructing a two-story high Glockenspiel in which live dancers will come out on the hour, and we will have celebrities every hour ring the bell telling you what time it is.
How fun. That's fun.
You know, every German village has a great Glockenspiel, and we thought we should too.
Chris, Pat, thank you so much for being
you
my
bet.
Guest.
Prost.
And thanks for putting on the Oktoberfest. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Crystal, there's been a lot of news lately about tax rates and whether the rich should pay more taxes, the rich should pay less taxes.
And what even constitutes, quote, rich?
And sometimes even what constitutes a tax if you look at healthcare reform. Regardless of who wins the election and who ends up controlling Congress, there's a lot of tax laws that are scheduled to change at the end of this year unless something happens and those changes get postponed. One big change is the capital gains and dividends tax rates.
You need to take action right now and really investigate whether or not any of these tax breaks that may vanish or change next year can benefit you.
For instance, capital gains are scheduled to go from 15% to 20%. Dividends, on the other hand, which are currently taxed at 15%, are scheduled to go up to the highest tax rate, which will be 39.6% and maybe even higher than that next year if you add on the 3.8% surtax.
And you mentioned the surtax, the 3.8%. That's for people who, if you file a joint return and your income's over $250,000, you may be subject to the extra 3.8% surtax on items like capital gains, dividends, rental income. So it's just very important to take a look at that, and if it makes sense to accelerate income into 2012, you need to act quickly and plan for that.
There's also some changes with regard to depreciation that are coming.
Well, you're right. The 179 deduction, which is the provision in the law that lets businesses write off this year up to $125,000 of qualified property, and that would be items like equipment, furniture and fixtures. Next year, the maximum amount that you can write off is only $25,000. So it's critical if you plan on placing a lot of equipment in place to at least explore whether or not it makes sense to make those additions in 2012 versus 2013.
Well, and besides the Section 179 deduction, the expensing, the bonus depreciation, which we've become used to over the last several years, is going away after 2012. So there will be much less depreciation deductions for equipment and machinery placed in service in 2013 versus what you have currently.
One other issue that I think a lot of people are just not aware of is that historically, over the last several years, if you have itemized deductions that you are able to take advantage of to reduce your income, things like charitable contributions, mortgage interest taxes, those were phased out for certain higher income taxpayers. You were only allowed to deduct up to 80% of those deductions. For 2010 through 2012, that 80% exclusion has not been applicable. But next year, in 2013, that phase out is going to come back with a vengeance. So again, just see whether or not you need to accelerate deductions into this year so you can take full advantage of them. The last point is the estate and gift tax breaks. We have huge estate tax breaks this year. If you are in the situation where you want to make gifts, think about that now, because in all likelihood, those limitations are going to go down in 2013.
Well, the moral is taxes are going to get worse, not better, for most people.
Well, we will just end on that happy note, Tom. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. You know, Tom, businesses, many businesses, are on the rise in terms of doing better in the economy. They're now looking to add workers, but businesses are a little shy about adding full-time employees because of all the uncertainty that exists in the economy, including how much their taxes are going to cost them, how much their health care costs are going to be for employees. So to have the workers that they need, many of these businesses are hiring independent contractors instead of employees.
You're right. I mean, independent contractors can save you money. However, you cannot have what I've heard some people refer to as a 1099 employee, meaning that they're really independent contractors. They have to actually be independent contractors, or you could be facing some substantial problems, taxes and penalties, if you treat people that should be employees as independent contractors.
And sometimes those lines are fuzzy as far as who is an employee versus who's an independent contractor. There are certain tests that you need to make sure that you can meet, as well as proper documentation that needs to be in place. So the key here is to know the rules.
And the rules aren't that clear. There's actually about 20 factors that are defined as what constitutes defining the relationship between two individuals as to whether or not it's an employee-employer relationship.
And the reason that a business might want to classify someone as an independent contractor, because they wouldn't have to withhold taxes on them. They don't have to pay the employer's share of taxes on the payments made to them. They don't have to cover them in their fringe benefit plans or health insurance if they're not a true employee. The key is really the amount of control. It really comes down to that, don't you think? The amount of control that an employer has on a particular individual performing services for the company.
That's the behavioral control. Do you control every action of the person, or do you control very little action and just reward them for results that they can do in any process that works?
So generally, if someone is paid for results, that is an indication of an independent contractor relationship versus an employee relationship. Another test is the financial control. Who's paying for all the materials, the equipment, the supplies? Who bears the risk financially of whether or not the job that the employee is doing is going to be financially burdensome to the employer or to the individual performing the service?
Well, and is the individual working exclusively for the employer, or are they working for a variety of companies?
And then the last issue is the type of relationship. You know, was the individual performing the service hired for a specific project for a particular limited time period? Are there contracts in place explaining the intention of both the worker and the employer? Are employee-type benefits provided to that individual? All of these issues need to be considered in determining whether or not a service provider or someone working for your company is going to be considered an independent contractor or an employee in the eyes of the Internal Revenue Service?
Well, the important thing is to make sure that you document all the facts, make sure that you talk to your advisors, including your legal counsel, and make sure that if you are treating someone as an independent contractor, you actually have a written contract.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is David Birdsall. David is the Senior Vice President at Strategic Investment Funds for Philip Edison & Company. It's got to be exciting. You guys have recently purchased the facility that we all watch as we, or look at as we drive down 71, Kenwood Town Place. It was originally intended to be a mixed-use project. Do you plan on keeping it that way?
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to maybe rework the wheel, but we're not going to reinvent the wheel. It's appropriately office because of the Midtown office market, the lack of an earnings tax in Sycamore Township, which makes it attractive to, you know, a number of businesses. It's a natural retail, just given the mall and the concentration of wealth there, the demographics that surround it. I think it'll be a different vision, but the original concept will be there.
Are you going to attract any special kind of retail businesses?
You know, when you buy something in distress, you hopefully buy it right. And we think we bought it right. And so we have the chance to start over. You know, we're going to keep the tenants that are there. They're, you know, we like those tenants. They're all, they're good operators and they're a good draw and their own unique. But, you know, we have a chance to do something that isn't necessarily going to be what you could find in any other market in Cincinnati. And we'll hopefully, you know, we want to get new to market retailers that are going to draw from Cincinnati, Lexington, Louisville, Indianapolis, et cetera, that people will come, you know, especially restaurants, because people will drive far for restaurants. So, yes.
For many of us who have been watching that facility, unfortunately, look like just rust out on the top. Will you keep the building the same, or do you have to dismantle some of it?
No, we're going to do some tweaks in the building. I just finished an architectural review of the building. We're going to keep some tweaks, as hopefully some of my investors are listening. We do not spend millions of dollars in investor money to buy something we don't know about. So we did have the building autopsied. We're very comfortable with, even though it looks bad, it's kind of worse than it is.
What was the driving force, David? Why did you decide to acquire the Kenwood Town Place?
There's very few chances, and really anywhere in the country, that you can buy a asset like a trophy asset in the number one retail market in a top 25 MSA and buy it at a significant discount to replacement cost. So you could not duplicate that building. I wouldn't want to duplicate it, but we bought it because financially we think it's going to be a home run deal.
Well, and you weren't just driving down I-71 one day and decide to do this. I mean, this is really what you do for a business, isn't it? You just do it all
right
over the country.
Correct. So it's our hometown. I think if this deal had been in Minneapolis, Milwaukee, another market where we really didn't understand all the nuances of the market, like how Sycamore works and how important Kenwood works and what's around it, that I don't know that we would have risked the kind of dollars, you know, that were going to be needed here. But because it's in our backyard and our hometown and we understand it, we definitely had home court advantage.
So Phillips Edison, as Tom mentioned, does have properties all over. Is that what you do? You buy these distressed properties,
right?
You fix them up and you turn them into magnificent centers?
Yeah, that's been the business plan for the last 20 years. You know, we own 250 shopping centers from Miami to Seattle, primarily grocery anchored, primarily in secondary and tertiary markets, small town. We were the kings of small town. And then when the world kind of changed, we had a fund and we decided to focus on bigger assets because that's where the opportunity was. And we're continuing to execute on that opportunity. We have a strategy. You know, there's a family of funds at Phillips Edison. Some concentrate on grocery anchored shopping centers and some concentrate just on buying triple net leases and some concentrate on opportunities. I'm an opportunist.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate. I'm Tom Cooney.
And I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And this is BusinessWise. Today our guest is David Birdsall. David is the Senior Vice President of the Strategic Investment Fund for Phillips Edison & Company. And your company's been in the news here in Cincinnati fairly recently because you purchased Kenwood Town Place. But that's just one of many properties your company owns all over the country. You probably have a pretty interesting perspective on just the real estate trend in general for commercial real estate. What's your viewpoint on that right now?
We're specifically focused on one niche of real estate, which is retail. And everybody reads the headlines and they say, oh, it's all going to the internet. Some of it has, and retail's creatively a creative destruction business. It's always reinventing itself and destroying former concepts. Just don't work. But the lack of new development has really helped everybody, because retailers have been forced to go back and look at spaces. They still got to open up stores. They have to continue to grow. They've actually focused on their operations and gotten better. I would tell you it's stable. But the good retailers like Macy's will figure out how to use the internet to get stronger and better, rather than seeing it like the enemy.
And really, the poor operators, they probably aren't around anymore.
Right. It's the same way that, you know, Walmart came in and everyone was afraid it's destroying everything. But the fact of the matter is it didn't destroy everything. It made everybody better. You know, Kroger became better because of it. Marsh did not. Biggs did not. Good operators better, and better operators even better. And poor operators, that makes them bankrupt.
David, I know that you are the individual who is the senior vice president for the Strategic Investment Fund, and Phillips Edison established that fund to really look for some opportunities around the country, I assume.
Correct.
Tom mentioned that you've recently bought the Kenwood Town Place, and for one person who drives up and down 71 all the time, I'm glad that it's going to look a lot nicer than it does now. Are there other opportunities that you're looking at here in our region?
Yeah, we're constantly looking, and we're the largest investor in the fund. So, you know, not only are we investing other people's money, we're investing our own money.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a golden rule. We're only going to invest in things that we want to own and lease. Unlike, you know, somebody that's tasked with putting out X millions of dollars a year, you know, we're going to buy good deals and opportunities that we see.
So are there still opportunities for people who might be interested in investing in real estate, commercial real estate, and taking advantage of some of these opportunities?
Sure, with us, yeah, we're going to, you know, we have the Phillips Edison family of funds. We have a public company called the non-traded REIT vehicle, which is really focused on core grocery anchored assets. The fund that I run is currently closed, but we're going to be back out in the market early next year. The world it's not going to reward investors anymore, which is what happened, or financial engineers, which is what happened the last mm-hmm. 10 years. It's going to reward operators. And the secret to Phillips Edison is that we're operators. We know how to operate in a shopping center and operate a development.
For people who would like more information about Phillips Edison, about the Strategic Investment Fund, where can they find that?
They can go to our website at www.phillipsedison.com. And they can also call Sigrid Campbell, who heads up the effort on the fundraising. And she's all that information is on our website.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Leroy Richard. Leroy is the CEO, the Chief Encouragement Officer for Lapse Sales Training, LLC. And Roy, I love that. CEO, Chief Encouragement Officer. You really go in and you help organizations, businesses, use sales techniques to create more profits for their companies.
Absolutely. It's about growing revenue, increasing sales, and increasing profit. But the CEO of Self, Chief Encouragement Officer, encouraging people to be the best person they can be.
You started the company when?
Back in 2005 on a part-time basis, and then on a full-time basis when I decided to step out, 2008.
From an economical standpoint, 2008 was not the best year for many businesses. What made you decide to start your business in that year?
You know, Crystal, it's never the right time. But when sales are down, business is down, that's the time companies need to focus on sales.
They don't always do that, though, do they?
No. One of the first things they do is beginning to cut budgets, and they just cut budgets as a whole. But when you start cutting sales, you're cutting the beginning of revenue.
Well, and the companies that really invested at that time took the initiative to maybe go outside of their comfort zone and mm-hmm. make those investments in sales, I think are really showing the success of that right now.
Yes, and they're reaping the rewards because they made the investment
right.
5 months ago or 2 years ago, and now the results are paying off.
So, Leroy, let's talk about sales, because, you know, so many people have their own vision of what a, quote, salesperson is. But I personally have the belief that everyone is in sales, regardless of what kind of profession that you're in, even us accountants.
Every person in an organization is in sales. Let's take a bank as an example. The lowest person on the totem pole in a bank typically is the teller. and that person is the lowest paid. But yet and still, that person has an impact, more of an impact on the sales of the bank than the CEOs in many cases. And if that experience with the teller is positive, the teller makes you feel like you're a human being with value, they want to come back and talk with you again and again and again.
So how do you help companies understand that you just don't go in and, quote, sell your stuff to someone? It's a lot more than that to get them to buy.
Yes, it is. And a lot of time companies are always looking for a quick fix. And what I do is go in and understand the problem the company is having. And most times it's not just one problem. But as it relates to sales, I want to make sure that the salespeople understand what they're there to do.
When you have kind of a unique program, a signature program that you use to help businesses understand how they can be more successful at this?
It's called Stop Selling, Start Wooing. And it's a three-phase process. You go in, you ask questions, you listen, and then you match your solution up with the customer's problem.
Well, that's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? Even though I think you understand that and I understand that too, for whatever reason, so many people want to go in and just start selling immediately, telling the customer all of the things that they can do for them versus really listening about what the customer needs.
And that's the way salespeople were trained many, many years ago. And salespeople are still using that process. The process I use is just a conversation. Mm-hmm. You want to go in and have a conversation with the person. Stop selling, start doing. Build relationship based on trust, win-win solution, and the sale will come.
If folks would like more information about your company, LAP Sales Training, or to learn more about the sales process, how can they reach you?
They can reach me on 513-315-5257.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Leroy Richard. Leroy is the CEO of LAPS Sales Training LLC. And Leroy, you call yourself the CEO of the company, which you define as the Chief Encouragement Officer. How did you come up with that?
Back in 1993, I was struggling with success. And I began to volunteer. And doing my volunteering, I learned that I was able to encourage people to be the best they can be. And as a result of that, I have adopted that as my mission, to encourage people to be the best person they can be.
Let's talk about what you do, which is help companies sell more so that they can be more profitable, increase their revenues so that they can show more on their bottom line. But there are some mistakes that people make. So maybe you can share what maybe the top two or three mistakes that you most often see that people do when they are in the sales mode.
What I notice is that a sales rep will typically go into a company assuming they understand the customer's problem. So they go in and start selling their product, telling the prospect what the product has done for others. What I want them to do is go in, ask questions, and listen.
Well, Leroy, one of the quotes that I see here on this piece of paper that I'm looking at that's part of your materials is you say that you help companies build relationships based on trust.
Yes.
And how do you do that, and why is that important?
Nothing happens until someone trusts you. You don't go out and spend your money with people you don't like or you don't trust. So how do you establish a trusting relationship? Number one, by being trustworthy. You ask people questions and listen to them. When we listen, the prospect or the customer feel like they're being heard. And the most important thing we can do is let people talk and we listen to them.
It sounds so simple. It sounds so common sense, right? But it is so hard for so many people to do.
Yes, it is. And Crystal, the reason that it's hard is because we have been brought up to talk, talk, talk. The most effective salespeople are the ones who can ask questions and listen.
Then they really understand the problem.
Right.
And then they can portray the services, the products that they have to best fit the solution to whatever that specific problem is.
You are a salesperson already. And you know, Crystal, when you understand the problem, the customer's problem, from their point of view, understand the financial impact of that problem to that person you're talking with, then and only then can you craft a solution that's specific to that problem. What my process teaches is to go in and understand the customer, understand their values, understand the company, understand their business, and most of all, understand what's important to that customer.
If folks would like more information about some of the information we talked about today, how can they reach you?
They can reach me by calling 315-5257, and of course, that's in the 513 area code.
Thank you for listening to Business Wise. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guests today are Mary Stageman. Mary's the Vice President for Regional Initiatives, and she's the Executive Director of Agenda 360 for the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. And Ross Meyer is also with us, and Ross is the Executive Director at Partners for a Competitive Workforce. And there's been a new report recently released, Mary and Ross, and it's called the 2020 Jobs Outlook. Maybe you can talk about that.
We came together with Partners for a Competitive Workforce, Agenda 360, Vision 2015, and the Strive Partnership to really get a sense of where's our economy going, where are the jobs going to be in the next 10 years, and how can we better prepare our workforce to fill those jobs. It's really building on a long history in our community of using data to drive action, and we really came together at this point in our economy to say, where are we headed, and how can we make sure that we're going to be able to prepare the kind of workforce that our employers need to fill these jobs.
And I think we were prompted to do this work by a convening we did about a year and a half ago of people who are workforce training providers, higher ed professionals and educators, people from the secondary schools around our market and so on. And they said to us that the best thing that we could do for them is to give them better data to make decisions and to help them understand what skills were going to be required for the jobs of the future so that we could connect the people that are producing talent in the pipeline to our employers in the region.
Well, that just makes all kinds of sense. I mean, it does seem to me that to the extent as a community, as a region, the different folks can be talking to each other from different groups. So the educators talking to the businesses to create and generate the kind of workforce that we need as a region to remain competitive, it just makes all kinds of sense.
Well, it makes lots of sense, but I think sometimes we're speaking different languages, and I think that's why the kind of work that Ross is doing at Partners is so important.
Yeah, and here's the challenge that I'm sure you've heard all the time from businesses that you work with is that, you know, we have a growing skills gap. And even in our economy, in our labor market right now, we have 140,000 people looking for work. And we hear all the time from employers that say we can't find qualified workers, and it's really because of a skills mismatch. So part of our reason for doing this report is to really get a sense of where are the jobs? What are the skills that are in demand so that we can really work with our providers and our training institutions to better prepare people with the skills to meet that demand, because it's one of the most important issues that we hear impacting business today, their ability to find good workers.
Well, where did you find that most of the jobs are going to be in? And
well, I think we've seen from the report, I think a lot of what we already know is strengths in our economy. Healthcare, you know, off the charts in terms of growth and good wages, good jobs, but also a lot of strength in IT-related jobs, tech jobs, as well as business, finance, insurance type jobs, but some strong growth in manufacturing and some strong job opportunities in construction as well. So basically, you know, what we're seeing is that, again, jobs that typically require higher skills, higher levels of education, are those that are growing the fastest and paying the best.
Well, even the manufacturing jobs, I'm guessing, are more skilled jobs, right?
They require much greater skill than they used to. And I think it's interesting, actually, that manufacturing did come up near the top, because we are rather unique and among many regions in this country, in that we still have manufacturing jobs as a significant part of our economy.
You know, gone are the days of low-skill, high-wage manufacturing jobs. Those jobs simply aren't coming back. But manufacturing is here to stay, but it's higher tech, and it demands a different kind of manufacturing worker than ours of the past.
Mm-hmm. If people would like information on how to get a copy of the Outlook, how can they receive that?
It's available on the web at regional-indicators.org.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Our guests today are Ross Meyer. Ross is the Executive Director at Partners for a Competitive Workforce. And Mary Stageman. Mary is Vice President for Regional Initiatives, and she's the Executive Director of Agenda 360 for the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. And Marion Ross recently, the report 2020 Jobs Outlook, a regional indicators report talking about the types of jobs that our community will be needing in the next 10 years was released. Maybe you can talk about how you're going to use that data, the results of that report, to really now fill those jobs or get a pipeline of our next generation of students into those careers.
Through our work with Partners for a Competitive Workforce, we essentially bring together employers with training providers and schools to say, you know, where are the jobs and how can we better retool the existing workforce for those jobs, help people who are out of work or who are looking for new careers develop the kind of skills they need for these jobs. So this data is really going to enrich our work and really provide an opportunity for us to really target our efforts to the jobs that are growing the fastest and the kind of sectors that are growing the fastest, to work with employers in those industries to really figure out how we can better train people for the jobs that exist.
How are you going to let just parents and families know and normal people about what jobs will be needed in the future so they can start thinking about those opportunities for their children?
There's a huge opportunity to get to kids and parents and teachers earlier on about where are the jobs in the community and what kind of pathways can help them get those jobs. So we're going to be working with Strive Partnership and other schools and districts around the community to really help get this data into the hands of teachers and career counselors, but also really work with our chambers to bring businesses into the classroom to talk about where the jobs are and how can I get those jobs. And I think that combined with kind of work experiences, be it summer internships or job shadowing, can really bring to life these kind of careers and help our young people understand that there are good jobs in this community and there are pretty clear pathways to get those jobs.
And I think that one of the things the report points out is that the places where the jobs will be in 2020 also align with where we're going at the chamber in terms of our focus on cluster-based economic development. And so the clusters, the industry sectors that we're looking at are actually the same sectors that came up in our Jobs Outlook report. So we're going to have a lot more sort of critical mass around certain aspects of industry and business that will help us really focus on the places where we have strengths.
Will there need to be curriculum changes in the schools, or is it more a matter of focusing students to go down the right paths of curriculum that's already there for the most part?
Well, I think we believe that there is room for curricular changes and curriculum reform in some ways. Ross and I would certainly agree that making sure that everyone comes out of their schooling, whether it's a post-secondary credential, an associate degree, or a bachelor's degree, they come out with work-ready skills and that they understand how to move into a career. That's critical. But then we have to get to the specific careers that we've been talking about and that came out in the Jobs Outlook, and that may require schools sort of teaching to the need in the community a little bit more than they have in the past.
If folks would like information about the 2020 Jobs Outlook, how can they obtain that?
Online at www.regional-indicators.org. The report and plenty more data is available.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your business advocate.